This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're gearing up for our annual spring series, North Carolina Voices. And this year, the topic is high school. Beginning May 15th, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, will offer a variety of reports on the high school experience in North Carolina. It's our own study, and in advance of that series, the State of Things is hosting a public forum featuring Howard Lee, the chair of the North Carolina Board of Education. That's this upcoming Monday evening, April 17th, right here in Bay 7 of the American Tobacco Historic District. The forum, free and open to the public, so we're going to tape that for broadcast on a later program on the State of Things. You are invited to attend that forum. Our Capitol reporter here at WUNC, Laura Leslie, is working on two stories for the North Carolina Studying High School series, and she joins us now. Laura, welcome.
Hi, Frank.
You're looking at some of the big picture issues that are playing out in the high schools across the state. And I guess one of the things you've been looking at is how bad is it? How bad is the high school situation in North Carolina?
That's a very tough question to answer, and a lot of it has to do with the way that we track and calculate how students are actually doing. I mean, North Carolina's high schools aren't the worst in the country, but they're certainly not. And they're not at the top either. And if you look at some statistics, we seem to be doing better here and there. But overall, it's difficult to get, as I said, a really accurate picture because there's so many different ways of collecting and sometimes cherry-picking statistics to make things look a little better than they are.
When the people at the top talk to you about the problems, what are the things that come up most often that top the agenda of policymakers at the state level?
Pardon me. A lot of the energy and attention has been going into pre-kindergarten programs and those early years, first, second, and third grade, reducing class sizes, for example, improving reading skills. And there's a reason for that because they say that studies have shown, actually, that whether or not you're going to drop out of high school is often determined by the end of third grade if you don't have the basic skills. They're also paying some attention at the top end to finding ways to reduce the dropout rate, and that is, I think, among the policymakers, the number one concern.
We talk about the dropout rate, but I guess there's a problem even in computing that the way the dropout rate is calculated has become controversial.
It all depends. You ask and how you qualify that, but the state says its dropout rate is somewhere around 5% a year. So if you stretch that out over 4 years, that's about 20% of kids that aren't finishing high school. The national rate is closer to 30, and some outside groups, including the U.S. Department of Education Statistics Department, says we're a little closer to 30% of kids that start ninth grade but don't finish. But you have to ask yourself, are you counting the kids that move? Are you counting kids who go into GEDs? How do you track kids who go into, say, the prison system or become homeschooled? That's a big part of that issue.
Now, that's the problem with the dropout rate and calculating that, but you suggested earlier that in terms of measuring success, that's a hard thing to do because if you go from one school to another, there are so many different ways in which we calculate success. Talk about that.
Even at a state level, there's a lot of discrepancy between, for example, we say that we've got 80% of our kids are proficient in math and reading. Okay, well, if you look at the national tests, we show up as close 30 and 40% proficiency. And we don't even make it to basic 80%. So, you have to look at what the state is asking, and what different states ask depends on the state and the people who are in charge of those departments of education. But on a national level, it doesn't look as good.
Part of the problem, too, is as you try to measure yourself against the various state standards, with No Child Left Behind offering its own set of criteria and its own set of sanctions if you fail to meet them, you run the risk that given what happens in any bureaucracy, there's an effort to make yourself look good, and that sometimes doesn't always make your product that much better.
Absolutely not. I mean, the students are the ones who really suffer here. I mean, you can ask about the federal statistics or the state testing or what the LEAs say about their particular dropout rates. But yeah, the ones that don't have the seat at the table are the students, and those are the ones that really suffer from this. Because if you think about the idea of 3 out of 10 kids not finishing high school, and you put that together with the fact that 2 out of 3 jobs being created these days require post-secondary education, not just a high school diploma, then you can see a real looming problem in terms of the workforce in North Carolina.
And it's always considered a serious problem and therefore always a subject for reform. And you talk to any teacher who's been in the system for longer than 7 years and they just shake their head and say, okay, here's the next reform they're going to throw out in 3 years. They're getting pretty cynical at some point, don't they?
Well, it's not hard to understand why, because, I mean, from the 1980s with The Nation at Risk, which was this big report that came out talking about how bad our schools were, we've gone through one after another sort of reform system, and none of, they sort of subside when the next one comes along. It's sort of the reform of the moment. Mm. But there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one is it takes a long time for reforms to work, and most of the time we don't have the political patience or the bureaucratic patience to wait and see whether that cohort that you're trying this reform out on is going to do better. Second part of the problem is that it's a moving target. I mean, what we expect of kids coming out of school today is different than it was 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. And so what you expect, what your end point is, keeps moving while the system is trying to go through its changes.
Well, we've heard from Governor Easley and others that we've got to train our kids differently, of course, find ways to prepare them for today's economic needs. Old mill worker training doesn't cut it. But what does it mean to train them for today when technology changes so quickly that being ready for today means your job's obsolete by the time you graduate?
That's a very good point. And I think Governor Easley would say it has to do with teaching them to think, teaching kids to think outside the box, forgive the cliche, but to think in problem-solving and critical and analytical ways. And that's really not the way that our high schools have been set up historically. They've been set up to produce, as you said, the mill workers, the factory workers of tomorrow. And he's saying we need to not just fix it, tinker with it. We need to overhaul high school. We need to sort of remake high school in the image of college and make the seamless continuum of teaching kids not just content, but ways to think about content and ways to keep evolving as the economy keeps evolving.
So give us a preview. What are some of the overhaul plans that are under consideration at the moment?
Well, the one that's getting the most press at the moment, of course, is the Learn and Earn programs, which are a program that Governor Easley started last year and or maybe 2004. I think it was last year. Anyway, it's a deal where if you go to school, one of these special schools, and you agree to stay for 5 years as opposed to four, you'll come out of it with an associate's degree. There's no tuition payment. It's a partnership between high schools and community colleges, universities, and private and public, where you go in and you're taking college courses even as you're taking your high school courses. So that kids are learning, even around at 9th grade, 10th grade level, that they can do this. I mean, part of what the problem, part of the group that this is targeted at, I should say, is that these are at-risk kids, mostly from families that don't have anybody that's ever gone to college. And it's a very scary proposition. It's expensive. They don't think they can do the work. And so the idea is teach the kids that staying in school is possible, that they're capable of it, and that they can come out of this in 5 years with a piece of paper that they can turn around and use to make a living. So that's probably gotten the most attention.
All right, Laura, well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks very much.
Laura Leslie is our State House correspondent at North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. We're talking about the trends and some of the new ideas that are being offered as a way of reforming the school system in North Carolina. Small schools, the newest trend in North Carolina. That theory is that large high schools just are not giving our kids the training and attention they need. WUNC reporter Rose Hoban has been looking at the making of one of those small schools for the upcoming North Carolina Voices series, and she joins us now. Welcome, Rose.
Hi, Frank.
Tell us a little bit. You're looking at one high school in Scotland County that's making the transition to a small high school. Talk about how that works.
Well, it's actually making the transition to six small high schools. What's happening at Scotland High is that it's a big comprehensive school. It's about 1,800, 2,000 kids. And they are chopping the school up into six small learning academies that will have no more than 400 kids each. That each learning academy has got a slightly different focus. One of the learning academies is a freshman academy. So they will educate all the freshmen together. All the ninth graders will stay together, and they'll have the same English teacher all year. They'll have the same math teacher all year. And they'll also be a little bit insulated from those older kids. And one of the thoughts behind that is that the ninth graders need some time to adjust and really find their feet in high school so they can be in the building, they can encounter the older kids at lunch and maybe a little bit in the hallways, but really they're on their own and they're kind of getting their own thing.
Just help them make that transition to high school.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And then the other learning academies, they are in transition right now. Currently, they've established two of these smaller learning communities. One is the Health and Science Academy, and one is the Engineering and Skilled Trades Academy. And those two have both been established. There are kids in those tracks, but this is the first year, so they're really trying to figure it all out. And then the rest of the kids who aren't in those smaller academies are in something that's called Scotland High. And then
they're going to be transitioned. So slowly they'll be part of one of these small schools. So is the theory specialization? Is that why we're doing this? What are some of the other benefits of these smaller academies within the larger building?
Well, there's a couple things that they're looking at. They're thinking that small is better. Actually, I've got a quote from one of the assistant principals who's now the conversion coordinator. She talked about why they're putting all their money on small. That's
Laura Horn.
Laura Horn.
There's a lot of research on schools that have 400 or less students in it, and the way you can build relationships between those students, with the teachers that are working with those students, and then the teachers that are actually in those schools. We had a really good department chair model. The English department was wonderful, and so was the math, and so was the science and social studies as well, and they were experts on what their department needed for their students to be successful. But nobody knew what anybody else needed. It was sort of not developing the total child. It was developing the social studies student or the English student.
So what they've done is instead of having this department where the kids go on one hall and all the English departments are on that one hall, they've got their school, and their English teacher works with their math teacher and their social studies teacher, and they all know that one kid from what they're thinking is a 360 degree angle, that they can look at the kid in all directions. So if the kid's not strong in math, but strong in English, or strong in social studies, maybe the social studies teacher can say to the English teacher, well, then maybe the next writing assignment should be something about social studies. And all of these teachers in this small learning academy then meet weekly and talk about the kids and talk about their strengths and weaknesses and what they can do to really engage them.
So it's a little more intimate experience. It's a more integrated experience in the sense that all the teachers are talking and you get to know the kids a little bit better, more intimate relationship with them. And at the same time, the schools can specialize a little bit and work on various aspects of education and training. But now, what about the other side of this, which is the fact that they're all in one big building does allow them the benefit of big schools in terms of extracurriculars. Talk about that a bit.
Well, there are definitely some economies of scale. I attended a baseball game. They've got one of the best high school baseball teams in the state. And I went to, it was a really good game. Yeah. And I went to a game with one of their arch rival high schools, and I talked to a lot of people in the stands, and a number of people had heard about this small school conversion, and some people were saying, one of the real concerns that they had when they heard about the small schools was that there was still this entity called Scotland High, mm-hmm. because the sports tradition there is very strong, and so what can happen is that they've got all these schools under this one roof, and they can draw from all those schools for things like band and basketball and football and maintain those kinds of traditions and yet give those kids the smaller school experience.
Now, I know that in the very early stages of transition, but any evidence that it's working?
It's scant. I mean, they've only been doing it really for a full semester, so they don't have a lot of data. They do collect data on disciplinary actions, and they've found that the disciplinary actions this year, they've had to take fewer of them. They've dropped from somewhere in the 50s to somewhere in about 32. So that's, they're thinking that maybe it's because these kids are getting this 360-degree view from their teachers that the disciplinary things can get picked up quicker.
A little more accountability, too.
Yeah.
Rose, thank you very much. Rose Hoban is our education and health reporter, a health reporter actually at North Carolina Public Radio, but doing education reporting for our high school series. Rural counties across the state face unique challenges when it comes to making high schools work, especially when you think about what happens if you fail under new state ABC and federal No Child Left Behind guidelines. WUNC Changing Economy reporter Leonita Inge is looking into one rural high school in Halifax County, and she joins us now to tell us what she's learned so far in her reporting. Leonita, welcome.
Hi, Frank.
You're working at Northwest High School in Halifax County. What's it like at Northwest High?
Well, the school is pretty big. There are about 900 students there. The makeup of the school, about 98% of them are minorities. Say about 85% are African American, and the rest of the mix is Native American and Caucasian. The schools, you know, as I drive there each time, I almost get lost. I mean, it's a beautiful drive, but there are like not many street lights, and it's very rural and it's beautiful. And you can tell they're very detached from, I guess, say, high schools in urban areas. One thing that I noticed right away, there seems to be a lot of pride at the school because a lot of the people in the community, their parents also attended the school, and their aunts and uncles and cousins. And not too long ago, they actually instituted uniforms there. I hear some folks fought it a little bit, but you can tell they've made the uniforms their style now. So everybody wears these bright orange and bright yellow shirts, or bright blue shirts, and khaki pants.
A real sense of legacy and pride in a school like that. And it's one of two high schools in the county, right?
Right, two high schools in the county. But the news that a lot of high schools in the state don't want to hear right now, both of those schools in Halifax, high schools in Halifax County, are on the list that if things don't get better, test score-wise, that they could be closed. There are threats of closing the school, you know, removing principals, removing school boards, or whatever, I guess, higher-ups feel needs to be done to help the students.
How is that reflected? I mean, what does it feel like to be in a high school where folks, the administrators, teachers, and the kids are all dealing with that?
Pretty tense. You know, I spend some time with the superintendent and the principal there, and I actually attended sort of a convocation, but an assembly awards program there not too long ago. And it wasn't an awards program, say, for all the honor roll students, because, you know, the top students, they get rewarded and honored and singled out all the time. This was actually a program for students who had improved at least one step on their end of course tests. So some of those students say they were considered failing, but maybe they moved up one notch, you know, because, you know, in some of these tests, you know, it's a 1, 2, 3, or 4, you know, four is the highest. So if they had a 1 and they moved to 2 or from 2 to 3, that's what they really want. So they could be on track. So those students were singled out. They were brought to the front of the auditorium. The band played and performed for them. The choir sang. Parents came out. And it was a very lively event. But I remember that one of the things the principal said, you know, sort of ignore what you read in the newspaper today, you know, ignore what people are saying around town that you're not smart and you can't be smart and you can't improve. You know, today is a special day. So they're dealing with a lot there.
I know you talked with Halifax County Superintendent Willie Gilchrist, who talked about some of the challenges that rural schools face.
Number one, I think their supplements or their salaries. The salaries in the rural got to be higher than the salaries in metropolitan. I know that's not a popular statement, but it's reality. Because it costs more for a teacher here to enjoy life than it would somewhere else. A teacher here may have to drive 20 miles to the store, where a teacher in metropolitan could walk to the store. Well, walking is a little bit cheaper than driving a vehicle. I think that's a major.
That's Halifax County Superintendent Willie Gilchrist. Yeah, what are some of the
other... Yeah, he was talking about teachers. Yeah, that's one of his top priorities is to retain good teachers there. And because the way that, I guess, teachers have been moving out, and it's a problem in a lot of rural areas. Sometimes teachers come there, especially very young teachers, and they stay just a little while and they move on. They want to move to a bigger district. And sometimes they want to move to a district where it may be a little easier. You know, it's not always easy teaching students that may have more challenges than other kids.
All right, Leonita, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks.
Leonita Inge is the Changing Economy reporter here at North Carolina Public Radio. And Leonita will be contributing to our series, North Carolina Voices, Studying High School. That begins May 15th. But beginning Monday, April 17th, the State of Things will present a public forum, and that will be a one-time event that looks at the challenges facing our high schools, what the schools are doing to try to meet them. We're going to tape it for broadcast as part of the series North Carolina Voices Studying High Schools. The forum is going to be here at the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. It'll be at 6 o'clock this coming Monday, April 17th. You are invited. It's free. It's open to the public. You can make a reservation online at www.wunc.org. Just ahead, Passover food and a StoryCorps conversation from Fort Bragg. Stay with us.